Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. Here it is Thursday, January 30th, 2014. The world's superpower has a serious and growing crisis in its nuclear command.
First and last man walk this earth, but only a few survive. I know this is a bus, and I've got it all planned for my first nuclear device. I don't really care about which way you vote, cause my gerrymander works out fine. I sell desert stretches like a big rubber glove to Japan for a nuclear device. Nuclear device! Nuclear device! Nuclear device!
We are sitting on the world's largest stockpile of nuclear devices. Even as we try to prevent Iran from joining the nuclear club, or do you say nuclear? I hope not. We don't set a very good example. Not only do we have the most nukes, but second perhaps to Russia, the security of those nuclear weapons is in serious doubt right now. We've had a wave of controversy, resignations and firings of individuals related to our nuclear command. Last August, the top nuke general, Michael Kerry, went on a trip to Moscow where he was reported to be drinking heavily at every stop. And one of the anecdotes is that while he was drinking heavy that Russian vodka in Moscow, he was chatting about physics with the cigar lady at his hotel. Now, these seem like comic book anecdotes. But these are the people who are guarding our nuclear weapons and who, at least theoretically, are prepared to launch nuclear-tipped missiles on short notice. And now we learn that in Minot, South Dakota, at the Air Force Base, the scandal about nuclear force officers who've been implicated in a cheating scandal about tests has expanded by fivefold. It has tripled. They originally told us that 17 officers may have, or at least were suspected or implicated in this cheating scandal. And now the number is 92, and there are only 500 people in this command. So that means one out of five are questionable, and that means that they are security risks. So we have the Defense Secretary summoning 15 of the top Air Force, Navy, and nuclear mission leaders to the Pentagon yesterday, where they talked about cultural problems. They discussed low morale and burnout. And apparently, being part of the nuclear command is considered to be a kind of dead-end assignment in the military. I didn't serve in the military, much less the nuclear command, so I can only speculate about that. But I'm very concerned, partly at the scope of this scandal, but moreover, that we don't hear a peep out of President Obama about this. Now, I know the State of the Union message is not where you trot out your dirty laundry. I understand the politics of that. But if you recall, at the end of the State of the Union message, the president brought out a badly wounded veteran of 10 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I didn't report on this in my commentary on the State of the Union because, honestly, I thought it was one of those, a calculated and cynical use of this individual to promote a kind of jingoistic nationalism. And by focusing on the hardship and the courage of this young man, who first met the president before he was seriously wounded, was used as a distraction. The president didn't talk about the sex scandals, the rampant sex crimes that occur in our military today, and that sexual crisis affects men as well as women? Not a word. Congress passed a watered-down bill to try to address the deficiencies in prosecutions of sex crimes in the military. The president, you know, if he's just emphasizing the positive, could have talked about addressing that problem. He didn't bring it up. He didn't talk about the threat that is posed in the current budget deal, the Patty Murray Paul Ryan budget that is now in effect and how it cuts funding for the pensions of our veterans. And so this nuclear command scandal is something that needs to be addressed. And it's not a laughing matter. It's not an issue of where, you know, there's money being wasted or political favoritism being shown. This could lead to a nuclear conflagration. It could lead to a mistaken launch. It could lead to poor judgment in the case of some challenge to our airspace. And while the Cold War is over and, you know, we don't have a clear enemy who is armed with nuclear weapons, the risk of a unilateral error on our part remains very serious. And I'll note that in the past, the president talked about sharp reductions in our nuclear arsenal, but that didn't come up at all in the State of the Union message this year. Edward Snowden has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And I think this is a very good development. It occurs because two members of the Norwegian parliament, Snorre Valen and Baard Vegar Solhjell, have placed his name in nomination with the Nobel Prize Committee. It's interesting because the committee doesn't release the names of nominees, but the individuals who nominate them are free to do so. And I think that this is a welcome world recognition of the role that Ed Snowden has played in exposing the massive surveillance by the United States of innocent people in our country and abroad. And I think that it will continue to spark the debate about these issues. In their nomination letter, the two parliamentarians said the public debate and changes in policy that have followed in the wake of Snowden's whistleblowing have contributed to a more stable and peaceful world order. And wouldn't it be great irony if Snowden is named to win the prize that Barack Obama collected in 2009 in a very misguided effort on the part of the Nobel Committee to nudge him into a more peaceful posture. And you may recall that shortly after he picked up the Nobel Prize, he announced an additional surge of troops into Afghanistan. And Barack Obama, I'm sorry to say, is not a man of peace. And we routinely recite for you the reasons why that is the case. So I'm glad to see it. We'll have to see how the committee sorts it out. And if he does win, it would be announced later in the year, usually in October they announce it, and they award it in November. More leaks attributed to Ed Snowden, this time via the Huffington Post and a Danish daily newspaper called Information. And this came from Laura Poitras. The NSA monitored the communications of other governments ahead of and during the 2009 UN climate negotiations in Copenhagen, Denmark. A document with portions marked top secret indicates the NSA was monitoring the communications of other countries ahead of the conference and intended to continue doing so throughout the meeting. It was posted on an internal NSA website on December 7th of 2009, the first day of the summit. It states that, quote, analysts here at NSA, as well as our second-party partners, that refers to Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, will continue to provide policymakers with unique, timely, and valuable insights into key countries' preparations and goals for the conference, as well as deliberations within countries on climate change policies and negotiation strategies. Now, here is another clear case where the NSA's spying is highly intrusive, aimed at friend and foe alike, and I think it's a real push to claim that climate change talks represent any national security interest of the United States. Now, we certainly have a strong interest in working with these other countries to produce a meaningful program to address global warming. But to me, this is seriously out of bounds. And this line is very interesting from the report. Members of the Danish delegation indicated in interviews with the Information newspaper that they thought the American and Chinese negotiators seemed peculiarly well-informed about discussions that had taken place behind closed doors. Particularly the Americans, said one official. I was often completely taken aback by what they knew. And I just think that this shows that we are told that it's all about terrorism, it's all about preventing the next attack, it's all about our security and keeping Americans safe. And we've seen now many examples of how America's spying doesn't fit that description in any way whatsoever. And we still need to fight on these issues and seek real reform on the surveillance state that has emerged here in the U.S. And I want to credit the PBS NewsHour. They're very timid on these issues. And we recounted for you how they interviewed Russell Tice and Bill Binney, the former NSA employees who became whistleblowers. And then they sat on the interview as they added in and pretended it was a debate. They added in a representative from the NSA who proceeded to deny all the things that Binney and Tice had said. And so PBS last night had an interesting report from Germany where Angela Merkel, in her inauguration address for her new term as chancellor, dinged the United States directly over our expansive spying programs. And I think it was Margaret Warner who did the report. She got some very interesting commentary from German citizens and even the guy who runs the German equivalent of the NSA. So if you have a chance, look that up at the PBS NewsHour website. Every day I pause to mention the people who support this podcast because I'm very grateful. I need their support and I need yours as well. We have a new annual subscriber I'd like to welcome, Jackie Winkus, who signed up and referenced that she learned about us from BoilingFrogsPost.com. Welcome, Jackie, and you got a new annual subscription, and we're going to be sending your bonus gifts out shortly here. I also want to mention Marianne Razzo, Janet Price, and Tim McKay. They subscribe and support this program every month, and I hope you'll do so too. Just go to peterbcollins.com, follow the links under my picture that say sign up. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever your budget permits. Or the best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber, like Jackie, you get a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee. A fresh shipment just came in from Russ Archibald on the Big Island. And we have our new bonus CD called Red Flag by Los Angeles singer-songwriter John Dist. And John is going to join us on the program for an interview next week, so you'll get to learn more about his politics and his music. The other way you can support us with or without a subscription is to take up the free offer from audible.com. You go to my website, and on the left-hand side, there's a vertical banner ad. You click on that, it takes you over to audible.com, where you can sign up for a free 30-day trial. And when you do, they'll give you your first audiobook download absolutely free, and you can choose from their hundreds of thousands of titles in the catalog. And if you exit before 30 days, you won't owe Audible a penny. But whether you stay with them or not, Audible will pay me $15 just because you tried their service. So this is a no-risk, no-cost way for you to kick in $15 to the PBC podcast, and I hope you'll click over there and help us out take advantage of that. Well, there is some progress in rolling back the war on some drugs here in the United States. And I'm pleased to see that the United States Senate and its Judiciary Committee have cleared a bill that would relax some of the minimum mandatory sentences, particularly for drug offenses, that have packed our prisons in a way that is so unjust that people know about it. And I'm not just trying to embarrass Joe Biden, the vice president, but he should be front and center on these efforts, because it was Joe Biden who led the hysterical charge to ratchet up the penalties for possession of crack cocaine after basketball star Len Bias died in the mid-1980s. And it was one of the worst things we've ever seen in domestic American law. And Joe Biden, to my knowledge, has never fessed up to his responsibilities. The other interesting development here in rolling back the war on some drugs is that a representative of the Justice Department, Deputy Attorney General James Cole, went to a meeting of the New York State Bar Association and invited lawyers who represent drug convicts to submit requests for commutation and pardon from the White House. Now, I'm a little bit wary of this. Barack Obama has been the least generous with his unrestricted pardon power of any president to my knowledge. Now, last year, he changed a little bit, and in December, he commuted the sentences of a small number of drug offenders. And the hopeful part of my personality says, okay, maybe he's gearing up that in his final years, he will empty our prisons of the people who are there for nonviolent drug offenses and who were sent for long stretches due to these misguided mandatory sentencing laws that have tied the hands of judges. But the proof will be in the proverbial pudding, and I don't have a lot of confidence, because if the Obama administration wanted to send a clear signal that it wants to make major changes in the war on some drugs, they would start by reclassifying marijuana and reducing it from a Schedule I drug way down to where it belongs. And it's very interesting here, too. In California, the district attorney of San Francisco and his counterpart in San Diego have publicly stated that they are preparing a ballot measure for California voters that would end criminal penalties for possession of any drug, including those on Schedule I, like heroin. And I think that this is an important step to putting a rational frame around these issues. And if you haven't heard it yet, I want to invite you to come to peterbcollins.com, and in the search window, enter the name Carl Hart, H-A-R-T. His in-depth interview is available to all now. You don't have to be a subscriber. And he is the fascinating professor of neuropharmacology, if I have it right, at Columbia University. 20 years ago, he was selling weed on the streets of Miami. He's a brilliant guy who is trying to return our whole drug regime to a rational and scientific basis. And I hope you listen to the interview, because appropriately was politely brushed back by Dr. Hart on a couple of points when he noted that, yes, even heroin has good applications, and it shouldn't be demonized entirely as an illegal and illicit drug. Also at the Justice Department, it was announced today that Eric Holder, who's personally against the death penalty, has decided to seek capital punishment for Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, the survivor and accused of participation in the bombing at the Boston Marathon finish line last April 15th. And as you know, I have many questions about the Tsarnaev case. His older brother, Tamerlan, appeared to be a CIA and FBI asset. He had been in contact with our government on many occasions. The uncle, who surfaced right after the FBI announced these two brothers as suspects and put them down, he has a background with ties to USAID and the CIA. The uncle lived with a top-ranking CIA official who was focused on Russia for a year and a half or something like that. And then, of course, there's the friend of the Tsarnaevs, who was being interrogated at his apartment in Florida, who was shot and killed by an FBI agent who said, oh, he grabbed a lamp, or was it a broomstick, or was it a sword, and came lunging at me, and I had no choice but to shoot him 6 times. The FBI has never explained that killing, and there are many other riddles with the Boston Marathon case and the prosecution here. And my expectation is that while they are saying that he's going to be tried in a capital case, I think they will plea bargain and take a guilty plea to spare his life in order to avoid public disclosure of all of these issues, all of the questions that linger about the FBI and our government's handling of the investigation into the April 15 bombing in Boston last year. Bill de Blasio is the new mayor of New York City. He He is a strong progressive, we're told. And I have a plus and a minus. I have a kudo and a brickbat for Bill de Blasio today. First of all, he has made good on a campaign promise to end the New York Police Department's stop-and-frisk practices, or at least to sharply modify them, to limit racial profiling, and to try to limit stop-and-frisk to people who are actually suspected of a crime. And I think this is a very good development. As we reported a few months ago, the judge who has handled this case for several years, a federal court judge named Shira Shindlin, I think was doing the right things. But they accused her of conflict of interest and of mismanaging the case, of making intemperate comments to the press. And it really seemed like a political witch hunt used as a pretext to kill the decision that she had made ordering the New York Police Department to suspend what she called its unconstitutional activities. And so I don't know how all that will be sorted out, but I am pleased to see that Mayor de Blasio is honoring that commitment. Now to the brickbat. I want to commend a group of, I don't know the exact number here, but it looks like about 50 New Yorkers who identify themselves as Jewish have pushed back on a private speech that Bill de Blasio gave recently to AIPAC. That's the American-Israeli Political Affairs Committee. And as you know, that is the Zionist promotion group here in the United States. And de Blasio, it's really hard to understand why he did this, but he's quoted as saying in this private speech, "City Hall will always be open to AIPAC. When you need me to stand by you in Washington or anywhere, I will answer the call, and I'll answer it happily, because that's my job." Well, I don't think that's part of the portfolio of the mayor of New York City. Now, there are many Jews in New York, but they're not all Zionists. And this list of prominent people, including Peter Beinart, our friend Michael Ratner from the Center for Constitutional Rights, music producer Danny Goldberg, many others, have written this letter. Erica Zhang is a signer. And the letter says, "We are Jewish residents of New York who read in the leaked transcript of your private speech to a meeting of AIPAC leaders. We understand that the job of Mayor of New York is a complex one that often calls for your participation on the international stage, and we would not presume to define your job for you. But we do know that the needs and concerns of many of your constituents, U.S. Jews like us among them, are not aligned with those of AIPAC, and that, no, your job is not to do AIPAC's bidding when they call you to do so. AIPAC speaks for Israel's hardline government and its right-wing supporters, and for them alone. It does not speak for us." Well, I congratulate the people who composed and signed that letter to Mayor de Blasio. Friday, in 50 cities of North America, including 34 in the United States, there will be public protests. It is a day of action to bring attention to the misguided and secretly negotiated Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And the president was so cagey about this that in the State of the Music, State of the Union message, he made a vague reference to Trade Promotion Authority. And what that really means is that he wants to submit this secretly negotiated agreement that is allegedly about trade, but only, what, 5 of 28 chapters of the agreement actually relate to trade. It is a corporate power grab on a global scale, at least from what we know about it. And members of Congress have complained that they are expected to vote up or down on this, that fast track would prevent them from making any amendments to it. So I hope that you will check in at, Trade Justice. Do a Google for Trade Justice. That is the group that is raising attention to these various protests that are taking place, as I said, in 50 cities of North America on Friday, February 1st. In the Ukraine, it's really hard to predict what will happen next. But Viktor Yanukovych, the president, who is facing a crisis that certainly could derail his government, decided to take some time off. He claims that he has a respiratory illness and a fever. I've got a respiratory illness right now. It's called a cold. But I'm still here hacking away. And Yanukovych is using this apparently to buy time and hoping that the protests will be quelled before he has to come back on duty. Now, he went on medical leave without signing into law a bill that is repealing the harsh restrictions on freedom of speech and assembly that were enacted just a few weeks ago. And so this very much complicates the situation. And I want to direct you over to BoilingFrogsPost.com because my colleague Eric Dreitzer has written a very important piece, and I will be the first to tell you I am no expert on the politics of Ukraine and the rising right-wing movements in Europe. But the piece that Dreitzer has written called Ukraine and the Rebirth of Fascism in Europe offers a very stark and a different appraisal of the protest groups who are backed by the United States and portrayed just as average people in our media. And he says that recent months have seen regular protests by Ukrainian political opposition and its supporters, ostensibly in response to Yanukovych's refusal to sign a trade agreement with the European Union. He says the political formation known as Pravi Sector, which translates to English as the Right Sector, is essentially an umbrella organization for a number of ultranationalist, read fascist, he says, right-wing groups, including supporters of the Freedom Party, the Patriots of Ukraine, Ukrainian National Assembly, and Trizub. All of these organizations share a common ideology that is vehemently anti-Russian, anti-immigrant, and anti-Jewish, among other things. In addition, they share a common reverence for the so-called Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists led by Stephen Banders, the infamous Nazi collaborator who actively fought against the Soviet Union and engaged in some of the worst atrocities during World War II. So, one thing we know for sure, the corporate media in this country isn't lifting a finger to help us understand the dimensions of the protest in Ukraine. We're also not seeing much coverage of the political show trial of Mohamed Morsi in Egypt. And I'm first to recognize that Mohamed Morsi may have not been a perfect leader of Egypt. But his political persecution by the military dictatorship that staged a military coup and threw him out of office 13 months after he had been elected as the first freely elected president of Egypt is quite stunning. And again, the United States, which has backed the military rulers of Egypt and has not uttered a peep as General al-Sisi, the leader of the generals, has announced that he's running for president under the new constitution that was just approved by voters in the last week or so. Well, Morsi is back in court, but because during the last trial, the judge kind of lost control of the courtroom because they had Morsi in a cage, but he could be heard. And he raised his voice and said, look, I am the legitimate president of Egypt. And he repeated that from the glassed-in soundproof booth. And, you know, we think of game shows where they say, the contestants are secluded off stage in a soundproof booth. Well, Morsi was on stage in a soundproof booth. And at one point, the microphone was switched on in his cage. And he said, I have been absent from the world since the 4th of July and haven't met anybody from my family or my defense. I am the legitimate president of Egypt. And the presiding judge shot back, I am the president of Egypt's criminal court. And then the microphone was cut off. And this is in no way a process that can be considered or confused with justice. And while I don't presume to know what is best for the people of Egypt, I know that what we're seeing is a new dictatorship that parallels the one that Hosni Mubarak ran for 20-plus years. And it is an ugly, authoritarian police state model. The Arab Spring is now just a piece of history. and likely Mohamed Morsi will be tried, and I expect he will be executed by the military leaders of Egypt. We've been talking about the Catholic Church and its phony objections to the contraception provisions in Obamacare. And I recently told you how I requested an interview with a representative of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. Now, at the time, all I knew about Beckett was from a press release they had sent me, bragging about how they're the people who represent the Little Sisters of the Poor, the Catholic Order of Nuns, that was used in a cynical way to challenge this provision in Obamacare. And I will repeat that Obamacare doesn't require anyone who doesn't want to use contraception to do so. It makes available at no additional cost insurance coverage for contraceptive devices or medications. And the reason it's offered at no cost is because the benefits of contraception, in terms of reducing unwanted pregnancies and reducing abortions, more than offsets the cost of distributing the pills and the rubbers and the other devices. And so it's very interesting because the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in March on two cases of for-profit companies that claim that the owners have religious objections to the health care law and its requirement that employers' insurance plans include zero-deductible contraceptive coverage. Well, the two plaintiffs that were granted certification by the Supreme Court are called Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties. Well, it turns out that Hobby Lobby is also represented by the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. So, the Catholic Church is aligning with religious conservatives who are not Catholics and claiming that for-profit entities, and the Catholic Church operates hospitals and other entities that are considered for-profit. These are corporations. They are not people. And so the two groups, San Francisco's city attorney has filed a brief with the court saying that allowing for-profit companies to deny contraceptive coverage to female employees for religious reasons would open the door to religious exemptions from local zoning laws, throw land use planning into chaos, and other unintended consequences. And California's Attorney General Kamala Harris, speaking for 15 states and the government of Washington, D.C., filed with the court a document that says corporations would demand similar exemptions from civil rights laws if they're allowed to withhold birth control coverage on religious grounds. And the fundamental argument here is that churches and corporations are not individuals, and they don't have the same rights under our Constitution. We'll see if the Supreme Court goes to the appropriate level or if they try to cop out on technicalities and give these plaintiffs what they're looking for. And lastly today, we learn that one of the lions of the left of the House of Representatives, Henry Waxman of Los Angeles, is going to retire. He joins more than 30 House members of both parties who are checking out this year. Now, a couple of things. Number one, this big wave of retirements makes it even more unlikely that Democrats will return to control of the lower house. Number two, Henry Waxman has a largely positive record of achievement as a legislator. He wrote the Children's Health Insurance Program Act. He took on anti-tobacco, food safety, and food labeling laws. He wrote the Ryan White Care Act, which allocates billions of dollars for the treatment of HIV and AIDS. He wrote the Clean Air Act. He claims he's proud of being one of the key authors of Obamacare. But my issue with Henry Waxman is that when the Democrats took control in 2007 of the House, Nancy Pelosi became the Speaker, and Waxman took over as the chair of the House Oversight and Investigations Committee. And he went through the motions of investigating the Bush administration for its wrongdoing. But he never pressed on any important issues. And the one that continues to gall me is that Henry Waxman point-blank promised Sybil Edmonds that he would invite her to testify about her FBI whistleblowing before his committee. He never did so, and when activists called him on it, he denied it. He didn't threaten to throw anybody off a balcony like Congressman Grimm from New York, but Waxman just buffaloed on the whole issue. And for that, I can never forgive him, and I think it leaves his legacy with at least one black mark. That's my news and comment for today. You are authorized to share this podcast with absolutely anyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.